The Guardian.
I'm Anushka Astana. This is Politics Weekly. Daring to hope. Jeremy Corbyn begins to articulate a plan to govern in a hung parliament and rules out a coalition. As the polls continue to show a Labour fight back, could the biggest political comeback in modern British history really be on? And what would it mean for Brexit? Meanwhile, Bernie Sanders pops up in Brighton to offer Corbyn some warm words, although not a formal endorsement.
Well, let me just say this. I have been very impressed by the work that Corbyn has done and the campaign that he is running, and I wish him the very best.
And Theresa May refuses to sign a European rebuke to President Trump for pulling out of the Paris Climate Agreement. So much to talk about, and I'm joined in the studio by The Guardian's chief leader writer, Randeep Ramesh, our columnist and author of a new book, Dismembered, How the Attack on the State Harms Us All, Polly Toynbee, and the author and commentator, Paul Mason. But first, I was in Reading this week for one of Jeremy Corbyn's campaign events on the morning that YouGov stuck its neck out and predicted a hung parliament that would see Labour gaining seats on 2015. Among the faithful, people were beginning to dream.
I think he offers us our best hope. I think he presents honesty, integrity, authenticity. Yeah. I think we're encouraged to choose leaders as if we were on the X Factor instead of thinking about finding the right policies that heal our nation.
And what policies do you really care about?
I think there are too many to count. I think even if he delivers half of what's in the manifesto, the country is transformed. So compassion for older people, educational equity, economic justice, I think there's more in there than I can say, and it's a country I want to live in.
I'm not an atheist. I'm somebody who's always been socially aware and socially conscious, and I've voted Greens in the past as a protest vote. I'm 48, so I've seen a few elections, and I've only voted twice in my life due to the fact there's never been anybody to vote for.
Because he's honest, he's true, and he's a socialist, and people have been waiting for that for a very long time.
And do you think the manifesto lives up to the promises?
I think it does, yes. I think it's the most radical manifesto since the post-war government.
Jeremy Corbyn, he's the one for me. JC, leader of the Labour Party. I have no choice but to vote this man, as I believe he can serve us in this troubled world. A change is needed from the status quo, as the Tories and the Blairites are ruthless and above law. And without this change, it all stays the same. No money for the poor, the old, the ill or the limb. Now, I'll get behind him as he needs you, because the right side of Labour are actually blue.
Do you think he can win?
I don't know if he can win. All that's in my power is that I can vote for him and I can not allow myself to be told what to think about him.
I've been a member of the Labour Party for over 40 years. I've always been a socialist. And now, it's not a dirty word in the Labour Party to call yourself a socialist. That's why I love Jeremy.
A lot of love for Corbyn in Reading. Now, back in the studio, and Paul Mason, we'll start with you. Those Corbyn supporters and many more like them are looking at the polls and at the state of the Tory campaign. Are they right to think it's game on?
Absolutely, because when you're in a situation like this, where a series of dramatic events are what's shaping the election, I mean, Corbyn's fight back isn't the only dramatic event. You know, Theresa May's flounce. We've got the Trump intervention now with walking out of the Paris climate change. People realise they are living in a world where something shocking and new almost happens every day. And they're quite prepared to believe that the shocking and new possibility of a Labour government in a week's time is possible. I think there's a kind of epic sense out there among those who are turning up to Jeremy's rallies of hopefulness. I recognise it from times like 2011 when people went on the streets. I recognise it, and I bet Polly may corroborate me here, from 1989 when a whole series of walls fell in people's minds and people realised things were possible. Of course, we're not in a position to win yet. I mean, 38%, 39% absolute max doesn't get you a Labour government. So the next week for Labour, all those enthusiastic people on the streets there, what they've got to be talking to is Conservatives.
Okay, and Polly, everyone is getting very excited about a tightening in the polls, although when you look at the methodology, they are all done quite differently. And I noticed that the closest ones required an 80% turnout from young people. Possible?
very, very optimistic. I mean, it would be revolutionary if that really happened. I mean, there are lots of reasons why the young don't vote, often because they're, you know, rented, they're not in the right place at the right time, they're at university or at home, or it's much harder, for they're not settled. I think it would be astonishing to get an 80% turnout amongst the young. I think the polls really will be under scrutiny this time, because there has never been as wide a disparity. I mean, there's some saying, you know, our own poll, ICM, saying 12% lead, and there's YouGov saying 3%.
And of course, our own poll is assuming a much lower turnout among young people. And I was quite interested to look at a graph the other day, which actually showed young people haven't always stayed at home in mass numbers. They used to actually vote just as much as older people.
Perhaps they were more stable then. There are many more, for instance, at university, and that destabilises. I mean, the great shocking thing was David Cameron deliberately made it harder for the young to vote by not allowing colleges and universities to automatically register everybody to vote. Of course they should have done that. Why was that stopped? Just to make it harder. And, you know, families would automatically register everybody in the household, no longer allowed to happen. Each young person has to register in the right place, not knowing when an election might be. And so it's not surprising that the young vote falls out.
Okay, and Randy, we talk about national polls. This is a very complicated ground war in 650 seats. It isn't something that is easily explained. Tell us, if Labour were to make gains, where would they be? And what sort of message do they need to be getting out in this last week?
I mean, I think Paul's right that the Labour Party has to reach beyond its core vote, especially to win some of those constituencies where essentially the swing vote is the Tory majority, or the Tory kind of vote, or the UKIP vote there. And that means appealing beyond the normal kind of boundaries of the Corbyn project. I'm glad to see that Paul saying that they will do that. Where? I mean, the problem with the polls is that they may get a very high vote share, but it may just pile up in the wrong places, which is the danger of the project, is that it corifies the votes. It's about its natural constituency, its base, which has done very successful and energising. I would like to see more policies that reach out. I think the tuition fees, paradoxically, even though The Guardian has been critical of that in terms of not doing benefit cuts, reversing benefit cuts rather than doing tuition fees, that actually swings the middle classes their way. So, in a lot of places where people want their kids to do well and they're thinking maybe we don't want to have this burden of £40,000, that might actually be quite an effective vote snatcher in places
like England. But not necessarily progressive.
No, I mean, that's what The Guardian's point of view is, that actually you could have spent that money better reversing Tory benefit cuts.
And Polly, can I just ask you about this? I mean, you've been writing passionately for many years about the human cost of austerity. Could it be that people are starting to be convinced that there is another way?
Certainly, austerity doesn't play the way it did in the last two elections, and nor are the Tories really playing very hard on that either, which is interesting. People are seeing the NHS falling apart. I mean, day after today, yet another story about the incredible long waits for operations. And people see in the local press, they also see there's a lot of stories about closures and rationalisations. The NHS scores very, very high and amongst top of people's concerns. I think people also, schools, the fact that suddenly schools are suffering real cuts, and next September a lot of teachers will have been fired, a lot of teaching assistants will have gone. Parents outside the school gates talk to each other, teachers talk to the parents about it. And I think that also is a great concern. So whereas austerity was the winner for the Tories, you know, we've got to stand together and tighten our belts, I don't think that washes anymore. So that helps Labour too.
And Paul, it's true. We've been all around the country. People are enthused about the message that Labour is putting out on schools, on tuition fees, on the NHS. But let's be honest, the Tory campaign hasn't gone particularly well either. Have you been surprised by the lack of discipline and the division that we've seen?
I don't think there's been a lack of discipline. I think there's been discipline around a serial wrong message from the Conservatives. I mean, if you're going to fight a presidential campaign, you don't hide from the public. That's the number one thing. If you're then going to fight a campaign, people are in a mood for hope. They want to know what comes after Brexit and after austerity, and there's no answers to either of those questions. But I also think by putting pressure in the middle ground, you see, I'll put my hand up. I publicly and privately have been a very strong advocate of university tuition fees first, welfare cuts last. because I wanted Labour to focus on, it's nothing to do with the middle class, it's to do with what is universal. What is universal about social democracy? And there are many sources of the money we need to reverse these things. One is growth, one is borrowing, and one is taxation. The debate was, what do you do with the taxation? How do you justify the taxation? A big raid on companies and on high earners. And the justification of it for me was, you do something that 50% of all households immediately benefit from. My argument on welfare cuts was, growth is the best thing that can happen to people who are on welfare benefits, is that the economy grows and the tax base grows and we deal with it that way.
Now, Randeep, here at The Guardian, we, you know, made a real effort not to get carried away with the Tories being well ahead in the polls, because polls have caused problems, and nor should we get carried away with the polls tightening right now, in my opinion. But what I would like to know really is, are there underlying factors that we might be missing, things that we perhaps missed on leadership in 2015, that mean in the end, people are going to go there and vote for Theresa May because they somehow trust her more on the issue of Brexit? Or is Paul right? Could people be looking for a more hopeful message?
I think the real thing about Theresa May is that there's a sort of, it's a funny way that the country appears to have bifurcated in two directions. One, it's moved to the left on economics. So many of the parties, Paul is absolutely right, 2 years ago were arguing about the deficit. No one talks about the deficit now. No one talks about it because the deficit is higher now than as an average than it was before 2008. Debt to GDP is now 90%. The Tories, when they talk about the magic money tree, they must have been wondering what they've been doing for the last 7 years because they've been borrowing like hell. So
they've got their own magic money tree.
It's in the Bahamas.
So, yeah. So, you know, that bit of it's solved. The problem, I think, is the cultural kind of signalling from the Conservatives. And that's where I think they do strike an advantage, because they have used a very nationalistic campaign. And there is this problem about a cultural feeling that the left is unpatriotic, and they're trying to tap into that. You've seen the smearing of Jeremy Corbyn today in the newspapers, but it's been a recurrent theme. And I think that sort of subliminal message or liminal messaging from the Conservatives is very strong. I mean, it's George Orwell who said of the left that they'd rather take money from the poor box at church than stand for the national anthem. And there is this kind of deep-rooted fear from, I think, ordinary people about the left not standing up for their country, and I think she's played on that.
And Polly, you know, Corbyn supporters watching what's happening in this election are frustrated that a number of commentators, including here on The Guardian, had a problem with Corbyn, not necessarily because of his policies, but because they were absolutely convinced he was unelectable. Is it time to say, hands up, we got that wrong?
We'll wait and see. Who knows? He's certainly fought a much, much better campaign than anyone expected. That's what he is. He's a great campaigner. You know, rallies, speeches, campaigning is his thing. And so also he started with such low expectations that the fact that he's really been rather good comes as a great shock to lots of people. My objection, well, yes, he has been better than I thought he'd be, much better. My objection was always that, this country needs a Labour government desperately. I've been in Knowsley this week. They were the poorest place, hardest hit with the deepest cuts. They desperately need a Labour government. And I will support whatever leader looks best placed to see that we get one. And I never thought it was Corbyn. Well, we'll wait and see if I was wrong. I hope to God I was wrong. I hope he wins. You know, I'll back him. And I've been on the phone campaigning for Labour. And I've been on the doorstep. And I've got posters on my window. I've never had any doubt about wanting Labour to win. I'm afraid I do have quite a lot of doubts about whether Corbyn can pull it off or not.
Now, I had the exciting task this week of being able to chair an event with Bernie Sanders, the American senator who challenged Hillary Clinton for the Democratic nomination, and a man who Jeremy Corbyn's team look up to. I asked him what he thought of the Labour leader and would he endorse his campaign.
I am aware of what Corbyn not only is doing now, but what he has done for the last several years. And what has impressed me, and there is a real similarity between what he has done and what I have done, he has taken on the establishment of the Labour Party, and he has gone to the grassroots, and he has tried to transform that party and take on a lot of establishment opposition. That is exactly what is taking place in the United States and what I'm trying to do with the Democratic Party.
And I am also impressed by his willingness to talk about class issues. Too many people run away from the grotesque levels of income and wealth inequality that exist in the United States, that exist in the UK, and exist all over the world. And I believe we will never make the kinds of changes that we need unless we take on this issue of income and wealth inequality and create an economy that works for all of us. Now, having said that, Jeremy Corbyn needs my advice. I think he's doing quite well, nor do I think the people of the UK need my advice on who to vote for. I think they understand it. But let me just say this. I have been very impressed by the work that Corbyn has done and the campaign that he is running, and I wish him the very best. But that was not an endorsement.
That was Bernie Sanders. Paul, do you think he can pull it off? And if he does, will you be going around saying, told you so?
No, A, I think he can, and B, no, I won't. Because I think the Tory catastrophe of a campaign, and to be honest, the tragedy of Manchester and the different kind of tragedy of Trump, pulling out of Paris, will affect the result adversely for the Tories. But see, what I think, this is a podcast for people who are interested in how politics works. So I think it's worth pointing out.
It's got mass appeal, Paul. What are you talking about?
But let's be a little bit nerdy. The people around Corbyn, finally assembled, were people who, and are people right now, who all come from one part of the Labour movement. We're talking about Seamus Milne, former Guardian columnist, Andrew Murray, Unite's chief of staff, Carrie Murphy, another Unite person, Katie Clark, former Labour MP, very identifiably on that left socialist traditional. I don't share a lot of the kind of political philosophy of that group, but what I have to say is, my God, they have, by kind of unifying their message and coming up with a strategy, and the strategy is, let's talk about what the country should be, not obsess about Brexit. I wasn't so sure about that, but I think it's actually got them where they are.
But don't you think there is a sense from some people that there is this great manifesto that, in fact, a whole coalition on the left can agree to rally around, but the fear is, among people, that those guys are much, much more radical than this manifesto. And my God, they might, do some things that voters might not like in Parliament.
I do not think they're more radical than the manifesto. And I also think what's been very important in Labour is that the Labour First group, the kind of Tom Watson traditional, what you might call centre stroke right of Labour in Labour terms, really liked the manifesto as well. Possibly it was the tuition fees was one of the things that they would have, if they had had a chance to not have to do a unanimous vote on the already leaked manifesto, they might have opposed it. But in general, they like everything else. So I think we're in a situation where they've crafted a consensus about domestic policy. I, as you know, stand on a wing of Labour that is Bevanite, effectively, that wants extreme left economic policies. Probably, I would push them further, but they don't want to go further. But I want incredibly solid policies on defence and national security, including nuclear deterrence. So, nobody gets exactly what they want, but I've got, really, in this kind of alliance that's leading this campaign, what I kind of thought was the best possible outcome.
But are you comfortable? I think one thing it's important to say is that people have said, the Tories have been very keen to say, this is just like the longest suicide note in history, manifesto of 1983. It is profoundly different because there is nothing in there that anybody on the left, we might have shades of difference about what the priorities would be. There's nothing in there that people could on principle object to. If you remember the 1983 manifesto, it was for pulling out of Europe, for pulling out of a unilateral disarmament, for pulling out of NATO. It was for things that people who broke away from Labour could not, in any honesty, support. There is nothing in this manifesto that anybody to the left of centre wouldn't be glad to see.
But someone like Paul, Prime Minister Corbyn, especially if he's got Deputy Prime Minister, unfortunately not Nicola Sturgeon because she's not actually an MP, but Deputy Prime Minister Angus Robertson, they're not going to be keeping Trident renewal on the table, are they?
I think they if the SNP come with, what we might get is a minority Labour government asking for support from the SNP. If the SNP come and say, we'll only support you if you get rid of Trident, I think they'll be told to go away with a flea in their ear, to put it politely.
Why would they be told that? Jeremy Corbyn doesn't want to tell them that.
He actually does, because he's a Democrat. That's the party policy. And he's listening, I think, hard to strategists and advisers who, the one example we have is what happened in Greece with Tsipras, left government. What is Tsipras? What did people, Tsipras's people say in private to people like Corbyn? Take on the elite on economics first, but do not at the same time try and dismantle the military technological sort of, you know, foreign policy consensus of the country. I've learned from that. I think Corbyn has learned from that.
Okay. Randy, Tory's still ahead, but another difficult blow for them. A candidate has actually been charged now by the CPS over election expenses, this after social care division and so on. Just put me into two scenarios here and think about Brexit. A Tory majority government, what does it mean for Brexit? A Labour SNP coalition, what does that mean for Brexit?
Well, I think for the Tories, it all depends on the size of the majority. If May has a large enough majority that she can ignore the kind of nationalist, isolationist heart of the Tory project. I mean, you've got to remember that she's in office, but not often in power. And we saw that over the national insurance attempts in the Chancellor's budget. So, you know, if she has a large enough party majority, she might be able to turn back those people like Steve Baker, like Bernard Jenkin, the people who actually run the troops, the Tory troops on the back benches. They're everyone's problem.
The hardline Brexiteers.
The hardline Brexiteers. I mean, the problem with Mayism is that there aren't any Mayites, and that's her real issue. She needs loyalty from people, almost fealty. I don't feel it from Conservatives at the moment.
She has boxed herself in on the Brexit negotiations. During the course of this campaign, she has made it her Brexit harder and harder. She's in no position to step back now, and that's very frightening. Whereas we know that, Labour on Brexit would approach our neighbours across the channel in a spirit of friendship. Well, let's make a deal that's good for both of us. She's approaching the European Union as if they were the enemy, as if he was going to war, a kind of absurd pastiche of Churchillian rhetoric.
Yeah, I must admit the Labour team has been underestimated on Brexit. I think Keir Starmer is a former DPP, very effective barrister, Emily Thornberry, barrister, Barry Gardiner has been very effective actually on the campaign. He's no fool.
And just tell me quickly, because I did mention the Lib Dems in there. I mean, a disappointing election for them?
Disappointing, especially given that they have actually a good set of policies. I mean, the single market, voting reform, and their economic policies are tax and spend. You know, it's an unfortunate time for them.
What happens is that, you know, if you go to some, there was like a big convention that The Observer backed 2 weeks ago in London, and a lot of sort of middle class, very sort of educated people turned up, and they were in agony about Brexit. And Bob Geldof's there, and he's talking about how do we stop Brexit and how do we sabotage it in another court case. But if you're a teacher in Somerset, then you're just surrounded by parents who voted for Brexit. And even if you're, so I'm thinking a teacher in Somerset is my liberal, you know, liberal sort of Lib Dem. You know, I kind of hope I want the Lib Dems
to. They'll get the teacher in Somerset.
I want the Lib Dems to retake the Southwest, but here's the problem. If you obsess about Brexit only, what you can't do is you can't walk down the pub and the rugby club and the toddlers group and start obsessing about it. And this is what Tim Farr's mistake has been, to assume that high-level sort of upper-middle-class, inside-the-beltway angst about Brexit is felt at low level, and even if it's felt, it's offset by the pressure, the social pressure of people around you. So that's my explanation. And I didn't expect this. I did expect, and in fact predicted on this programme, Labour to come back quite rapidly to where they are now. But I never expected the Lib Dems to do so badly.
Okay, and enough of the optimism. Let's leave our listeners with a bit of pessimism. If Labour lose, what happens? Paul, have Corbyn and McDonnell weakened their grip on the party or strengthened it?
I don't think it's about a grip. Losing means losing seats and doing really badly. Let's say that. I think in that situation, there'll be a battle over party democracy. That's the first thing that'll happen. And after that, I think people would have to then say that's the last normal election Corbyn has ever fought. But if we're in a hung parliament situation, then we're in a very different scenario.
Randy?
Well, I think they elected Jeremy Corbyn in a fit of grief. I think there'll be a fit of anger. I would hope that the PLP learns its lessons, takes a summer out, and thinks again about how they take Labour Party forward.
Importantly, to give us a rest. Polly, finish us off.
Well, It depends, of course, how badly Labour does or how well it does, and it'll make a big difference. But the idea that somebody who has failed in one election should ever stand again, I mean, you know, Kinnock did, and it didn't turn out so well. So they do need a new leader, and then there will be a great battle as to the method by which that leader's chosen and whether that's somebody of, you know, of Corbyn's part of the party or not. But for the time being, what really matters is making sure that Theresa May gets as small a majority as possible, that there are as many Labour MPs returned as possible, so as to stop her getting too extreme over the Brexit negotiations. That should be foremost in everybody's mind now.
Thank you all, Polly Toynbee, Paul Mason and Randeep Ramesh. Enjoy the rest of the election campaign. That's all we've got time for. Please follow all of our coverage on theguardian.com/politics. The producer was Phil Maynard. I'm Anushka Astana. Thank you for listening.